Hi Krishna, good morning. It's a special day today. It's the beginning of Bhishma Panchaka and it's Ekadashi. So it's a good day to invest in spiritual things. So today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, chapter 15, text 4. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So today's topic is how to deal with frustration, or is there a way to avoid frustration, which is, it's interesting, and I like to speak a little bit before where we are, or maybe we'll read the summary. Can we read the summary of the chapter? And maybe I'll just tell the story. Okay. So, anyone remember who Vitrasura was?
He was a demon who became the enemy of Indra, and who had a great fight with Lord Indra, and Indra ended up, because he had acquired a weapon from Lord Vishnu, his thunderbolt, he was actually able to kill this demon who no one else in the universe was, could stand against. He took over everything. He was, no one could fight him. The only one who could fight him was Lord Vishnu. I mean, it was Indra, because of the weapon that he had from Lord Indra.
So Vitrasura was born to kill Indra, but there was a mistake in the way they uttered the mantras. His father was very angry at Indra because Indra killed his son, so he did a fire sacrifice and he created his Vallabha Sain Prabhu, said it's very powerful demon that no one can defeat. And there was a big fight between the demons and the demigods. And at a certain point, all the demons ran away. But Vitrasura stayed and he fought so fearlessly that it's described that the demigods were fainting just by seeing him. He didn't even have to touch them. They just saw how angry he was. They were falling on the ground. And he was very angry. He even swallowed Indra, but Indra had a special kavacha, Naran kavacha, so he was able to survive. And then all the demigods asked Indra to kill Vitrasura, and Vitrasura had a discussion with Indra. And in this discussion, he showed very amazing devotional qualities. I think the chapter is called Vitrasura Shows Devotional Qualities, or Devotional Character. He had a very philosophical discussion in the middle of the fight. He told Indra, yes, kill me because I want to go back to Godhead. And anyway, I got a demon body and I want to give it up. And he recited very nice verses that some of them considered to be the jewels in the Bhagavatam, like some Vaishnav recite them every day. Some of them are very famous verses. So in the end, Indra had to kill him. He didn't want to, but he had to, because all the demigods were asking him, and he understood it's his duty. And after he killed him, Maharaj Parikshit is asking, how come such a demon is a devotee? And Prabhupada explained in the purpose, he explained how rare it is to be a devotee. He explained that most of the people, like let's say in Gainesville, most of the people are not interested at all in spiritual life. And then you have people that are interested in spiritual life, but they're not becoming devotees. They're becoming like in the mode of goodness or doing different things. Then out of those few, there are few that are interested in spiritual life, and some of them becoming personalists. So being a devotee is very rare. Krishna also says in the Gita, Manushyanam Sahasreshu, out of many thousand, one become a devotee. So Maharaj Parikshit is asking, how come this demon is a devotee out of all the people? And actually, he showed better devotional qualities than Indra and the demigods. So he was very surprised. So in answer to those questions, we are now hearing the story about King Chitraketu. And King Chitraketu was a very powerful king, and he had one dream. Anyone knows what was his dream? He wanted to have a son. And he wasn't destined to have a son. And it's very difficult to accept our karma that we want something and we are not destined to get it, because we have a dream, we want something, and we think that this dream will make us happy. But he couldn't get a son. He had, I think, millions of wives, and all of them couldn't give him a son. And even the animals in his kingdom weren't able to give sons. It was his destiny. So one time Angira Muni came, his very powerful sage, and he saw the king, and he saw that he was so sad. And he asked him, what's wrong? And he said, I really want a son, and without a son, nothing really works for me. I don't want to live anymore. And Angira Muni had the power. So he created the sacrifice, and he gave him a son. But because he wasn't destined to have the son, he told him, this son will bring you happiness and sorrow. And that's what happened. He had a son, and everyone was really happy. All the people in the kingdom were happy. They knew how much the king wanted the son, and they had big celebrations. And everyone was focused on the baby. All the attention, all the love went to the baby and to the mother of the baby. But he had so many other wives, and they became really envious because they didn't get any more attention or love or care. And they decided to poison the baby. And they did poison the baby. And when his mother came, she found the baby dead. It's actually, first was the nurse. She came and she tried to wake him up, and she couldn't. And then she called the mother, and the mother tried to wake him up. But the baby was dead. So all the happiness that was before became into great lamentation. And practically speaking, all the kingdoms start being completely devoured by lamentation. Everyone was just crying, and the king was near his dead side. His dead body of the son was laying near it, and he couldn't function. And then again, Angira Muni came with a friend. You know who's the friend? Narada Muni. And they didn't say who they are. They were in the crowd there. And they were looking at what's going on. And it's very heavy scene, actually, when someone really young dying. I remember one time I was working in a hospital for a few months to save money to go to India. So I saw a lot of things there. I was in the emergency room. And usually when old people die, it's a lot of sorrow, but people accept it. But when young people die, it's such a shock. I remember one time, one young person, he fell from somewhere, and he was completely dead when they brought him. And then all his family started arriving, and they were crowding the room there. And it was nighttime, and I was there. And the doctor couldn't tell them. It took him long, long time until he decided, he got enough courage to go and say he's dead. And those people were from a certain part in Russia where they showed their sorrow by, I guess, letting out the anger. So the place became such a chaos. They start taking things. They practically start breaking everything in the emergency room, and I had to call the police, and the police came, but the police couldn't do anything because you have so many frustrated and sad people, and they're just throwing things on the floor and banging their head to the wall, and it was such a shocking thing. So Narada Muni and Angira Muni are standing there, and they want to help the king, and everyone is lamenting. And Angira Muni decides to ask a question. And the question he asked, he stand up and he walk and he said, no one knows who he is. And he said, oh king, what is your relationship with this dead body? And everyone is very surprised. And it's kind of obvious. The king will say, I'm his father and he's my son. But then Angira Muni asked, was this relationship existing before this baby came? And is it existing now, when this dead body is there? And will it exist in the future? So it's kind of shaking the whole reality of the king and the lamentation. And that's where we are coming in the story. And then we'll tell the end of the story. After we read, remind me to tell the end of the story of Chitraketu, because it's a very exciting end. So, Andy, will you lead everyone in the Sanskrit? The one on the screen.
So I just say them and we'll all say them together? Or?
Yatadana suvaidana.
Yatadana suvaidana.
Bhavantina bhavanticha.
Evam
bhutani bhuteshu.
Koditani
shamayaya.
And word for word?
Yatadana suvaidana. Bhavantina bhavanticha.
Evam
bhutani bhuteshu.
Choditani
shamayaya. Yatadana suvaidana. Bhavantina bhavanticha.
Evam
bhutani bhuteshu. Choditani shamayaya.
Evam bhutani bhuteshu. Koditani shamayaya.
Bhavantina bhavanticha.
Evam
bhutani bhuteshu.
Choditani
shamayaya.
Let's read the translation and the purport. Anyone volunteer to read, maybe from the ladies?
Maharaj Chitraketu was actually not... Oh, sorry. When seeds are sown in the ground, they sometimes grow into plants and sometimes do not. Sometimes the ground is not fertile and the sowing of seeds is unproductive. Similarly, sometimes a prospective father being impelled by the potency of the Supreme Lord can beget a child, but sometimes conception does not take place. Therefore, one should not lament over the artificial relationship of parenthood, which is ultimately controlled by the Supreme Lord. Maharaj Chitraketu was actually not destined to get a son. Therefore, although he married hundreds and thousands of wives, all of them proved barren, and he could not beget even one child. When Angira Rishi came to see the king requested the great sage to enable him to have at least one son. Because of the blessing of Angira Rishi, a child was sent by the grace of Maya, but the child was not to live for long. Therefore, in the beginning, Angira Rishi told the king that he would beget a child who would cause jubilation and lamentation.
King Chitraketu was not destined to get a child by providence or the will of the Supreme. Just as sterile grain cannot produce more grain, a sterile person by the will of the Supreme Lord cannot beget a child. Sometimes a child is born even to an impotent father and sterile mother, and sometimes a potent father and fertile mother are childless. Indeed, sometimes a child is born despite conceptive methods, and therefore the parents kill the child in the womb. In the present age, killing children in the womb has become a common practice. Why? When conceptive methods are taken, why don't they act? Why is a child sometimes produced so that the father and mother have to kill it in the womb? We must conclude that our arrangement of so-called scientific knowledge cannot determine what will take place, what is enacted actually, despite the Supreme Will. It is by the Supreme Will that we are situated in knowledge? Certain conditions in terms of family, community, and personality. These are all arrangements of the Supreme Lord according to our desires under the spell of Maya, illusion. In devotional life, therefore, one should not desire anything since everything depends on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as stated in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.1.11. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana kaumadya navritam anukulyena krishna nushilanam bhakti uttama madhya 1967. One should
render transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord Krishna favorably and without desire for material profit or gain through fruitive activities or philosophical speculation. That is called pure devotional service. One should act only to develop Krishna consciousness. For everything else, one should fully depend upon the Supreme Person. We should not create plans that will ultimately make us frustrated.
So I like to read the three verses before, just to give you a more complete understanding how interesting the way that Angira Muni is preaching. We can call it in modern times, it's like a reality therapy. He's telling him what's the reality and he's shocking the king. So Shukadev Goswami said, while King Chitraketu, overcome by lamentation, lay like a dead body at the side of the dead body of his son, the two great sages, Narada and Angira, instructed him about spiritual consciousness as follows. By the way, I remember reading, anyone know the meaning of the word Shudra? We use it when we say the Varna Ashram, there is Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra. Anyone knows maybe the meaning of Shudra?
One who laments unnecessarily.
Yes, thank you. So a king is not supposed to lament. It's supposed to be only for very low-class people to lament because they still don't have the spiritual knowledge not to lament. And there is a one ancient story in one Purana. I won't go into it, but it's a sage and a king, and the king come to acquire knowledge, and he bring him presents, and the sage say, "Oh Shudra, why did you come?" And the king is very offended. No one called him Shudra, and he tell him, "You are a Shudra because you are lamenting. It's not that you are a king. I can see your qualities, and if you are lamenting, it means you are a Shudra." And then he instruct him. Sometimes they have a very shocking ways to kind of shock the person who come. So that's one of them. So the king is lamenting, and they come to save him from this lamentation. "O king, what relationship does the dead body for which you lament have with you? And what relationship do you have with him? You may say that you are now relate as father and son. But do you think this relationship exists before? Does it truly exist now? Will it continue in the future?" And that's actually the characteristic of the material world. They're giving him, I guess, the first step of not being frustrated is to understand the nature of the material world, to understand. If we understand the nature of what reality we are in now, we can move to another reality, to a spiritual or different reality. So, anyone remember a verse that describes the characteristic of the material world in the Gita? Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. What's the meaning? Temporary and miserable. Is it real? It's real. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a subtle point that we are different. The philosophy of Krishna consciousness are different from many other philosophies. That we say this world is real, but it's like a dream. And the way it's like a dream is that although it's real, it's very temporary. And I'll try to give an example. Like many years ago, I worked for a short time in an insurance company, and one of my services was to go to the bank. And one time they had, it wasn't illegal, but they had some deal that someone stole a lot of computers, and they wanted to give him a lot of money and get back the computers without involving the police. So I found myself one time going to the bank and getting a big suitcase full of money. I don't remember how much it was, maybe 50,000, maybe 100,000 shekels, not dollars. But anyway, so for 1 hour I was very rich. I was walking with this suitcase and I thought, wow, I can do so many things. And then I came back to the office and gave them the suitcase. So was it real? Yeah, it was real. But was I in any way affected? Was I a rich person? Not. So in the same way, this world is temporary. We identify with all those things, but they are passing by very quickly. And they are like dreams. They just continue to pass by, and we identify with them for some time, and then they go away, and we lament. Like when something is difficult for us, we're waiting that the time will pass by and it will be better. Like me and Andy was speaking yesterday, and I was telling him about my military service, which I didn't like, and I didn't want to be part of the army. So I was all the time praying that it will end. But when it ends, it's like nothing. It's like a dream, and you continue to... I thought I would be so happy after I finished the army, but then a day after I finished the army, I had to find a job and do this and do that. So we have this. When it's difficult, we all the time hope that it will pass quickly. And when it's good because of our karma or the stars, or we have some good situation, we want to hold it and hope it will won't change. And guess what? It will change after some time, because that's the nature of the world. It's all the time, it's temporary, and it's all the time changing. So when we become attached to something, we are lamenting. And when something bad happens, we kind of hoping the time will pass very quickly and it will be better. So the first, I guess it's those, this chapter is more gyan. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, you have the first instructions for Arjuna. It started with gyan. You are not this body. Arjuna also in a very frustrating situation. He's a big warrior, he's very strong. No one in the world can conquer him, and he promised no one will tell him to put down his bow Gandiva. But then he's there in the battlefield, and he has all his relatives, his teacher, his cousins. Everyone is in front of him, and he starts breaking down. His attachment is so strong. He himself put down his bow Gandiva, he's crying. It's very unusual for someone who got military training and is a great philosopher like Arjuna, but he couldn't stand it. So Krishna started to tell him, you are not this body. I'm sure all of you know this verse. Let's recite it together. Dehino smiñata dehe komaram jovanam jara tatade hantara praptir dirastachanamuyate. So Prabhupada, he giving this purport to that the verse before that, he give this verse because the first step, if you don't want to become frustrated, is understand you are not this material body, there is something else. And the next step will be, don't be entangled in it. Don't deal just with the matter. So For this verse, in this verse, the Inosmin Krishna says that someone who sees the continuity from boyhood to childhood, from childhood to boyhood to old age, he can understand there is something that is not the body. There's something different. The body is changing, the body of a baby, then he becomes a person, then he becomes an old man. And if you look at the picture, you wouldn't recognize the same person, but if you ask the person, he will say, that's me, that's me, that's me. So it means someone is there continuing, and this someone is the soul. So that's the basic step, which is not easy. I mean, it's easy to say the Inosmin, and it's easy to learn the verse, but to really understand it, like when I go to the dentist, it's a challenge to remember, I'm not my body, I'm laying there, and it's like... And I'm like, I'm not my body, but it's very difficult to have the practical philosophy. And it's possible, even for people who are not Krishna conscious, to understand they are not their body. Prabhupada gave a famous example about Stalin. Stalin was a very powerful leader and a very powerful murderer. I think he killed more people than anyone else in the history. Right? So he had to go into operation, and he was sure that if they will put him to sleep, he will die, because someone will kill him. He had so many enemies. So he decided to do the operation without any drugs. And they operate on his body with him just laying there and looking at the ceiling. And Prabhupada give this as an example how you can, even a person who doesn't believe in God, he can overcome thinking that he's only his body if you have a dream or a vision or something you want to achieve. So I guess back to our point, the first thing is to understand you are not your body, and don't get entangled into things that are connected with the body. And then the next step is to understand the nature of the material world that is temporary and full of suffering. And then the next step we'll read a little bit more. So that was two. Number three. O King, as small particles of sand sometimes come together and are sometimes separated, due to the force of the waves, the living entities who have accepted material bodies sometimes come together and are sometimes separated by the force of time. So this verse and the verse we read is speaking about relationship in this world or in this realm of reality, and the relationship are very difficult. Anyone want to guess why it's difficult to have relationship in the material world or in the material reality?
When you become attached to something, then you're automatically fearful that you have to give it up at some point. So it becomes a source of your lamentation.
Ultimately, it's going to end at some point, so you give us misery.
Also, there's no satisfaction in any material relationship. It's simply based on either gross or subtle sense gratification. And since we're not these bodies, no matter how much sense gratification we get in these relationships, they're completely, 100% unsatisfying.
I agree. I would just like to add that when you are in a temporary situation, you cannot really have a long-term relationship. What I mean to say is we really long for a relationship that will be forever. We want to love someone, we want to love him forever, we want to be loved by someone forever. And when we have a temporary body in a temporary world, it's very difficult to relate to things because, as Mother Chaitanya and Nimai Pandit said, they will be taken from us. Let's say, for example, not even with people. Let's say I'm buying a house. How long can I stay in the house? I want some shelter, so I will invest and buy a house. But how long can I stay there? I guess the best case scenario, until I leave my body, and then I have to give up the house. So it's very difficult to have a long-term relationship in the material world, and that's what he's telling him. He's giving the example that sand and small sticks are sometimes coming together and sometimes going apart, and no one should lament about it. And again, it's a very high philosophy, and it's shocking. I mean, it's not high philosophy, it's simple philosophy, but it's supposed to shake the way we see reality, and that's why it's very uncomfortable to read it, and it's challenging to read it. So I want to see if anyone have any comments or questions before we try to make another point, because it was a lot of things.
Thank you. One thing that struck me when the translation is, one should not lament over the artificial relationship of parenthood. I was just wondering what's meant by artificial. Does that just mean artificial because it's temporary?
That's a good question. On the floor. Our relationship with our parents are artificial because they are temporary. That's a good question. Anyone like to answer?
It depends on whether you're the parent or the child.
Who feels what?
The parent feels that it's real. At least teenagers. It's important to understand that these relationships are artificial in their physical sense, but they're also real. So like when you had that money, it wasn't your money. You were holding it. So in an absolute sense, we could say, yes, these relationships are artificial like that. But on the other hand, you had a duty to do with the money. So you were responsible for the money while you held it. So you did have a relationship with that money. It just wasn't in your possession. So also one's duty for Krishna can be executed by taking care of some relationship like that. So it's artificial in the sense if we think we are the owner of this child, but it's real in the sense that it's our duty to take care of the child for Krishna.
So what you're saying is we're getting a gift from Krishna to have a child for some time, and it's our duty to take care of him, and then I guess it ends, but it's still we are doing our duty. It's temporary and real.
But aren't our relationships like karmically based? You know, like how does that follow through with being artificial? Like like the people that are around us, isn't it because of like past karmic relationships and stuff? So how does that fit in with being artificial?
Another good question. So we didn't say it's artificial. Just we asked the question according to the translation, and then you're saying that we have certain karma to work up relationship with someone, and that's give the meaning to the relationship. I guess that's what you're saying. We are not by chance around the people, we are around them.
So then also the sage was asking to the king, it's like, what is your relationship with this? And like, doesn't that relationship continue? Like, isn't it come from before, you know, like karmically or something? Like, I don't know. I'm confused.
I was just thinking, well, the whole thing when the sun comes back to life and he enlightens Chitraketu by saying, oh, well, when were you my father? You know, I had so many. So we have all these relationships, and they're artificial in the sense that, like, in this lifetime, we might be thinking, oh, this is my mother, or this is my boyfriend, but who knows what they were in another lifetime. You know, it's like, but we're totally identifying with them, because it's like a bodily identification. They're all spirit souls, and we might have had some connection with them before, but it's artificial the way we're seeing it. You know, it's not the reality. The whole picture.
Also, the artificial relationship is based on a real relationship. The real relationships exist in the spiritual sky. There's unlimited parenthood, unlimited friendship, unlimited love in the spiritual world. But the difference between those relationships and the relationships we find here in the material world is that in the spiritual world, all these relationships are based on devotional service towards Krishna. Where here in the material world, none of those relationships are based on that. At least most of them aren't, except devotees. All the relationships here are simply based on the mind and the body, and that is artificial. But real relationships are completely existing. That's why we're always looking to try to find friendship, family, and love. But we're always being frustrated because it's not in relationship to Krishna. It's in relationship to our own selves.
What you're saying is it's like a reflection of the real relationship. Like this world is a reflection of the spiritual world. The relationship, it's also a twisted reflection of our real relationship.
The understanding I like, what I understood from it is it like the right understanding? Like, if we can have two souls which may want to be related for a long period of time, they can be relatives for many, many lifetimes. So what Vallabh Sen Prabhu said, that souls won't get that true satisfaction which they will get with Krishna. So at some point of time, they will sort of get fed up of each other, or will be satisfied. They won't find the satisfaction with each other, and the true satisfaction lies with Krishna only. Is that what artificial means in this context?
I believe there are there are different levels, because when you say two souls, but they are in I guess in different bodies, and it depends how much they relate to the bodies they are, or in what realm, I guess that's what we all the time speaking about, what realm of consciousness we are. So it can be yes or no. If you are on the level of the soul, you see things differently, and if you are on the level of the body, you see differently, and there are a lot between them. I'm not on the level of soul, and I'm not completely on the level of I'm a body, because I read so much of Prabhupada books and chanting, so it's between. So I guess what they're trying to explain here is, as much as you go into the spiritual reality, you will find more satisfaction and less frustration, because you will know. Is that answer your question? Yeah. Please, Prabhupada.
Also, so far as what Prabhupada is saying, there's only one soul, but the soul can be under the influence of the material energy, which is called false ego. And then he could be under the influence of the internal energy, which is our real identity, our real ego. So until we come to the point of being frustrated with our false identity and our place here as God, as the controller and enjoyer of the material world, until we come to that point, it's very difficult for us to understand our real identity as Krishna's servant. There's only one soul. Different states of consciousness. One is false, one is real.
Stephanie has questions. I just wondered if that's like a simple way to put it. It could be that the connection is real, but the position is what, artificial. Because even the relationship can be real in the sense that once the understanding of the relationship with the Lord in the heart and the understanding the relationship of a servant, then the relationships are becoming real, even with the son, with the parent, you know. So anyway, I just thought that might be like another way to see that.
Chai Prabhu, very nice class. So I guess to add to Stephanie's question, so do we have relationships between, like in the spiritual world, do individual souls have relationships with each other? Or is it just, do we have, we don't just have independent relationships with Krishna, right? I mean, it's we all have relationships with each other. Or does it, do you know?
I believe yes. Yes, I believe even the relationship we have now, I don't see them as not real. They're real. It's just what I understand, and I invite other people to comment also, because it's complicated. But what I understand, it depends on the level of purity and the devotional element inside the relationship. That's what will make them. Like when you read about, we were reading yesterday about Gaur Kishodas Babaji, and when you read about the dealings of those Vaishnavas between themselves, they're very real, and they're very full of love. And there is one description, I don't remember it's Gaur Kishore or Jagannath Das Babaji, but he met someone else, and they hugged, and they fell to the ground for like 18 hours, hugging each other without consciousness, until the servants somehow or other find a way to wake them up and separate them. So that's real, and that's in here, but their consciousness is different, and they experience the love differently. Does that answer your question?
There are definitely relationships in the spiritual world between the devotees, and in the material world also, in this world. The difference in a Krishna-conscious relationship and an ordinary relationship is that Krishna is at the center, and it opens up a great many avenues for improving that relationship when there's a common interest in Krishna, whether it's relationship between friends, between husband and wife, between parent and child, any relationship that might exist is enriched by the fact that both parties feel that the real purpose in life is serving Krishna. So immediately there's a common interest. So this is just not some dogma or theory. It's very practical. It really, really improves the character of relationships and makes life much more bearable and pleasant. And these relationships are often so frustrating that people just want to give them up altogether. And people get interested in spiritual life. That's often the first thing they do. I'm just going to go off by myself. You know, I'm tired of all these stupid relationships. But in fact, that's an idea that doesn't satisfy the heart, because we all need relationships. So putting Krishna in the center is the key. And that then the material world becomes a spiritual world.
It's how to transform, I guess, your relationship. So yeah, it's a question, I guess, where to have the focus. It's a lot of details, but I guess I don't know if to tell them the story about Buri Janu Jagatarini. We had a very interesting lecture a few days ago. We were driving and it's Buri Jan Prabhu. He's a very nice devotee from Australia, and his wife Jagatarini, and they told how they got married. And it's very interesting to see, I guess, Krishna conscious relationship. She was an actress, a very famous actress. She did a movie with Mick Jagger, and she was on a way to fly from America to England to promote the movie. And she was chanting from time to time. Someone introduced her to chanting, but she wasn't really serious about chanting. And one devotee in Australia, he gave her a pen, and he said, please give this pen to Srila Prabhupada. So she stopped in L.A.? She stopped in L.A., yeah. You want to tell the story? I'm trying to remember all the details. She stopped in L.A. and she went just to give Prabhupada the pen. And the devotees were there preparing to go for Harinam. And Vishnu Jan was there leading them. And they say, would you like to come with us? And she said, okay. She said they looked very enthusiastic. She said, I will go and see what they're up to. So she went and they chanted for a few hours. And she started crying. And she started to understand that all her life as an actress and all the things she achieved till now weren't as exciting as chanting with the devotees, and she decided to give the temple president her ticket and her money and just join the temple. So she Yeah, she said some bags are still in the London airport. She never went back. So she joined the temple and she met Prabhupada. And Prabhupada asked her about different things. And then he said, are you traveling alone? And she said, yes. And it was inconceivable for Prabhupada in the 70s that a 21-year-old girl is traveling alone. He said, you're not with your family. And she said, no. And he said, I will find you a nice husband. And she was very horrified. She said, the last thing I wanted in my life is that they will find me a husband. And it's a very interesting story how she actually, the first time she saw her husband was 1 hour before they got married. She had to leave the country and they wanted to build a new temple in Hong Kong. So what they did is he was preaching in Japan, so he came from Japan, and they sent her to Hong Kong, and they met 1 hour, and then they got married. And it's a long story, but I guess the point is, they say that Prabhupada is in the middle of this relationship. They say we had a lot of struggles, we didn't know each other, and they are now more than 30 years married. And so every time they have fight or difficulties, they think Prabhupada will be so displeased if we walk with each other, if we break the relationship, and that's what keeps their relationship alive. It's not the only reason, but it's one side of it. So. I guess I wanted to add this as an example how a relationship can be based more on spiritual than material. Because materially it's very difficult to conceive that someone will meet the person 1 hour before they get married and they will stay together so many years and do service together and be happy with each other. It's not that they are suffering. They are very exemplary couple in the movement. So I'd like to summarize what I found out. Sure.
So the conclusion would be that we can not avoid frustration in the material world. We can only tolerate it with the help of the knowledge. Would that be the right understanding?
I would say differently. I would say to understand that the material world is a place of misery, and to be able to transform it by changing our consciousness will mean that we will not feel any more frustrated. And that there is this verse, I'm trying to remember the verse. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasajatina Kanchati. So it says that people who achieve, they didn't even achieve Krishna, they did achieve some level of consciousness. They are in what we call Brahman. They are always happy. It's not that they are suffering. It's described that they are happy. They are always in bliss. So let me summarize the 3 points I wrote. How to overcome frustration. So the first one is to understand that there is spirit and there is matter and they are different, and that you don't want to be entangled in the material body. The second one is to understand the material world that is temporary and full of suffering and it's like a dream. And then to try to be engaged in devotional service while you are in the material world. And to understand also that the relationship that are based on the body are temporary. And the ones that are based on Krishna conscious, they are internal. So, thank you. Hare Krishna.